Well, this is a very great chapter, and I'm going to start with one or two introductory comments. First, you should not expect too much of me. That is, I do not claim to have infallibly all the details worked out with every connection. I don't think there is a complete consensus amongst Christian commentators of the evangelical school on this chapter, and I don't pretend to be giving you the last word. Secondly, you should not expect too little, on the other hand, from Mark. That is to say, we have already found him a highly intelligent, if not brilliant, teacher. It would seem very odd to me if he were to take hold of the language of apocalyptic and just do some spellbinding stuff, which is rather like the Times crossword. I don't think he's likely to do that. If he is not clear, then I shall be very surprised. I am expecting this chapter, therefore, to be in keeping with all that we've seen from him so far, and to be leading in the same direction and to be teaching the same lessons. And Mark here writes as a pastor. He tells us here the teaching of Jesus that sustains people's faith in times of trial. It's true that there is the language of apocalyptic here, but actually the purpose and form of the chapter is very different from much Jewish apocalyptic. Just to give you an example of his pastoral heart, verse 7, don't be alarmed. Verse 11, don't be anxious. Verse 21, don't be misled by prophets who seem to be very effective. So these are all warnings, knowing that Christians will be alarmed, that they will be anxious, and that they will be misled if they're not careful. Again, what an important thing to remember, that this is a post-resurrection document. Therefore, those who've experienced the marvels of Acts 2 might easily imagine that that kind of day was going to be repeated every day. But it's not. There are going to be all kinds of testings and difficulties and perplexities in the days ahead. And yet at the same time as great tribulation, there is going to be great triumph. And the triumphant verse in the chapter is, of course, verse 10, that the gospel is a universal gospel that's going to be preached to all nations. So the place of this chapter is very dramatic, really. We've come, haven't we, to a clear ending at the end of chapter 12. We're now waiting for the story of how Judaism kills their Messiah. But before we hear the story of how the Jews take their Messiah and crucify him, we hear the story of how the world is going to hear of him. In other words, before we plunge into the terrible news, which seems to suggest that the whole thing comes to a tragic end, we have a forecast that, in fact, this news of his death is going to spread throughout the world. So, although there is great tribulation here, there is also great triumph in this chapter. In this chapter, then, the Lord looks ahead, and he gives a picture to the disciples of what the church age, as we might call it, is going to be like. And what the whole chapter implies, quite simply, is that he is the Lord of history. That's the meaning of verse 20, for example. If the Lord had not shortened the days, he can shorten days or lengthen them as he wants. History is in his hand. This is the meaning of verse 27. He will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. All belongs to him, and his angels can go just where he sends them and do just what he asks them. That's the meaning of verse 31. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. If the whole of history can come to an end and his word not come to an end, then he indeed is the Lord of everything, because his is the last word. And, of course, that he controls history is the meaning of the doctrine of the Second Coming. I don't think, actually, that we have anything like enough about the Second Coming, but one of the reasons we don't in modern evangelicalism is that a generation before our time entered into that whole business of Adventism. The rector of Seven Oaks, just before the war, was said to preach morning and evening on the Second Coming and when it was going to be and so on. Evangelicals in those days did. And that, of course, is a total misunderstanding of the doctrine of the Second Coming. The stupid illusion that we can foretell or forecast the future must have slain its thousands, mustn't it? And the doctrine of the Second Coming has got nothing to do with that at all. It is the purpose of this great doctrine is to assure us that Christ is Lord, of course. Because if he is at the end of history as well as at the beginning, then he is Lord. And the Bible says that Christ is at the beginning of time, and he's at the end of time. So he's the Lord of history. So this great truth tells us that he has the last word. If the city knew who's going to have the last word in the Westland thing, well, then the whole thing's simple, isn't it? All the city needs to know is one word, Sikorsky or European. If they knew that now, many people could make their fortune. It's all they need to know, who's going to have the last word. And we now know who's going to have the last word. And therefore we can face up to all the terrible things that are mentioned in this chapter. The whole of this chapter is a great dissuasive against Adventism, against this foolish business of chasing dates and looking for the moment. What then is Christian watching? It is not stargazing. And the whole chapter comes most wonderfully to a conclusion in that final story, 33 to 37, which is unique to Mark, and therefore I think it's worth reading at the beginning. Of that day and that hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. What a lot of trouble that gave to some of the early commentators in the early church and ever since. But it puts Adventism, doesn't it, right out of court. If Jesus does not know on earth, then how can we know on earth? Take heed, watch, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work. There's the crucial statement, typical Mark. Each is left with his work and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Watch, therefore, if you don't know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, midnight, cockcrow in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all, watch. The opposite of working is sleeping. Therefore, the Christian is a watchman. He sees that none of the things in this chapter deflect him. That's the point of the word watch. He sees that none of these things deflect him from following the Lord Jesus and getting on with his work. Neither false prophets, nor tribulation, nor catastrophes, none of these things which are going to be very disturbing and distracting, stop him from his work. And so we are left with the marvel, aren't we? Of that, the marvel of the universal church, the real, the living church, the true church, the marvel of it is that it's at work today. Have you ever thought of that? It hasn't had its master with it now for 2,000 years. Do you remember when you were in 4B and the master said he was going along to the common room to get a cup of coffee? How soon did it take for chaos to start in your form room? In mine, about 15 seconds. Right, so the Lord says he's going, and he's going for 2,000 years, as it turns out. And what's happening today? Are we all asleep? Isn't it a marvel that we're not? After long years of sleep, they're waking up in Plaxtal and the Potteries and in the city and everywhere else. It is a marvel. It's a miracle. What it means is the Lord is truly the Lord. And that's what this chapter is all about. So let's keep our feet firmly on the ground at the end of chapter 13. It's characteristic Mark. None of the things in the church age which seem so tragic should stop you from this work to which you've been committed. There is, of course, a tension in the chapter between Jesus' coming being near and his coming being not yet. There'll always be that tension. As Cranfield's got a superb chapter. I think Cranfield, I owe more to Cranfield on busting all this nonsense we were taught if we did liberal theology about how the early church was mistaken about the second coming. There's nothing more common than liberal theology than that. It's absolute poppycock, of course. And Cranfield simply takes them to the cleaners in a way that I've not read anywhere else. And I leave you to read it for yourself. But one of the things that he says that I think is very helpful is that the incarnation, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension, and the coming of Christ are all one event of the coming of the kingdom. But what has happened is there's a delay between the ascension and the return in order that people may be saved. But we must see them as one great event, the king coming to rule his world. And, of course, in one sense, therefore, his coming is very near. It's taken place, indeed. In another sense, it is not yet. And that tension goes right through our lives, and I'll say something about that later on when we get to the end. Now let's begin the chapter. As he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." One of the great wonders of the world, of course, the temple. And Jesus says, a chilling words, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left one stone here upon another that will not be thrown down." In other words, he announces the coming of judgment. Now, I want to make a point here because I don't want to have to keep repeating it. We saw right at the beginning of Mark part 1 that we had two quotations, didn't we, in verse 2 and 3 of Mark 1. Do you remember? One was the quotation that the judge was coming to cleanse his people or destroy them. And the other was that the Lord is coming to save his people. Either he was going to judge or he was going to save. Those are not two different things. Oh, they are different things, but they're the two sides of the same coin, aren't they? Every action of God in Christ is an action of salvation. Every action of God in Christ is an action of judgment. We all know that in preaching the gospel. Every time we preach the gospel here on a Tuesday, we trust that men are on the way to salvation. But alas, we know, and it's a horrifying thought, that this preaching of the gospel is sending some men on the way to condemnation, because they will not listen, and therefore it hardens their heart. Every action, therefore, in this chapter which talks about judgment is also talking about salvation, because you can't have the one without the other. So God, when the chapter starts with Jesus saying that the judgment is coming on Israel, you know already that that's not just a tragic statement. Judgment is going to release salvation. Now, why is judgment coming on the temple? There's more to it than simply what we were learning this morning. It's more to it than the fact that they have rejected their Lord. They do not know God. The answer is this: how can the presence of Israel's Lord be in this world when he has been rejected by this world? In other words, now that God, who came down and made a people in this world, has been rejected, he can no longer have his headquarters in this world. The idea of a temple is, of course, an anachronism and an illusion, isn't it? Must be. If this world has said, "We will not have this man to reign over us," there cannot be any palace for him here on earth. That's why every building from St. Peter's Church, Rome onwards, every great cathedral, is an illusion. Because it is supposing that God has some kind of palace or headquarters on earth. But we've rejected him. He gives a false picture of the situation. He must be an absent Lord because we've rejected him. But since he is the Lord of glory, if we've rejected him and he's an absent Lord, then he must at the same time be a coming Lord. Do you see the logic of that? He must be an absent Lord if we've rejected him and he's gone. The whole of Mark says if you tell him to go, he'll go. But since he is the Lord, and we have told him to go, he must be a coming Lord, because the last word can't be with us. So the great statement of Mark 13 is that he is an absent Lord and a coming Lord. The absent Lord takes seriously the sin of man. The coming Lord takes seriously the sovereignty of God. Well, now, needless to say, of course, the disciples don't know, in the immortal phrase of John Chapman, don't know beef from a bull's foot about what he's talking. And so as they sit by the Mount of Olives, they have a private session, as usual in Mark. Don't you love these private sessions in verse 3? They say privately, "Tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign when these things are to be accomplished?" That's a very good question, isn't it? When is all this going to happen? Of course, that's a rather superficial question, and yet it is still the question, isn't it? When is it all going to happen? We know that this is much more than the destruction of the temple. It's the entire act of God through Christ towards the world of salvation and judgment. And what they ask him for is a sign that his word is true and that his purposes will be accomplished. Now remember that. They ask for a sign. And you will know what Jesus has to say about signs in Mark. So if they ask him for a sign of his victory, of God's coming to judge and to rule, what are the signs that he's going to give them? Now, I have to tell you that I walk very warily here because I'm by no means certain that I've got the way in which the answer should be put correct. I mean, I think I know what the answers are, but I think how we arrange them and understand them is not quite clear to me, and I hope you'll be able to help me. There are signs of judgment and signs of salvation. I'm simply going to do what Cranfield does, which was to list them. The signs of judgment are paradoxical to a degree, but the signs of salvation are a bit plainer. So, there are not many. Let me list them through the chapter. Here are the signs that Jesus reigns. That's what it really means. And that he's going to fulfill his purposes in the church age. First, false prophets. Now, false prophets are mentioned twice in verse 5 and 6, take heed that no one leads you astray, and in verse 21 and 22, false prophets and false Christs will arise and show signs and wonders. The fact that Jesus mentions false prophets twice in this great statement, this great discourse, means that it's a matter of outstanding importance. He says concerning these false prophets that many will follow them, verse 6. Many will come in my name saying, I'm he, and they will lead many astray. There will be many of them, and they will lead many astray. We have a charming example, of course, in Mr. Wimber, in my view, and many indeed are following him. The second thing that is said in verse 22 is that the elect, if it were possible, would follow him, but are in fact in the end ultimately not deceived. Verse 22. To lead astray if possible, if it were possible, the elect. But it isn't possible in the end to lead the elect astray. But it's a near thing. That's the implication, isn't it? So here are the false prophets. This is the sign. You see how wildly paradoxical this is and how important it is to see the whole drift. How do I know that Christ rules his church on earth? How do I know that he rules the world? And the first sign of that is the false prophet. This is part of what God in judgment will allow. Their stock in trade will be threefold. Individual pretentious claims, verse 6, I am he. It's actually only two words in the Greek, I am. So you can see how pretentious that is. Secondly, verse 22, they will do signs and wonders. And thirdly, of course, they will give an apocalyptic map of the future. Theirs will be the religion of fanaticism. Verse 21 has a very simple command to his church. Don't believe them. Don't believe them. Just as God allowed the false prophet in the Old Testament to test whether his people would follow him or not, so the false prophet is allowed by God in the new church age to test his church whether they will follow him or not. Marvelous quote from one of my gurus here, no real rival to Christ is possible for the Christian. The only one to be believed in, the only one whose word is sure and trustworthy, is the one who speaks in the great discourse of chapter 13. Just wish we could grasp this. Wish we could get evangelicals to grasp this. No one is trustworthy, however great a person they may be. However great a Christian leader they may be, we do not trust their word. The only word we trust is the word of Jesus. Therefore, we're calling upon our leaders constantly to take us back to it, isn't it? Who said just now that he was making the effort not to make it his word, but Christ's word? That's right. We've got to make a special effort, haven't we, all the time in all Bible study to say, we're not coming here to listen to what a man has to say, we're coming here to listen to what Jesus has to say. I'll do my best in study and preparation to be ready to tell you what he's saying. But I have no magic. My training at theological college has given me no wisdom. We need to say this, I think, increasingly. I don't have anything to give you. I want to point you to the one who alone can teach you. Otherwise, the charming Wimbers appear and they knock hundreds astray because they appear to have a crucial answer to everybody's missed. Wimber doesn't know anything more than we know. There's nobody who knows anything more than we know if we know what Christ is teaching. There are no secrets. Nobody can come along with a new word. There isn't a new word. So the false prophet is a great test. I don't know whether you call him a characteristic of the church age or a sign. That's what I think I want to work out at the end with you. Second sign, catastrophe. 7 and 8. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place. But the end is not yet. International catastrophes, verse 8, earthquakes, famines. That's 1985, isn't it? What catastrophes we had in 1985? And indeed, we had a catastrophe just a few hours ago, and in the paper the next morning, yesterday morning, some girls in the school of that mistress, that very attractive woman as she seemed to have been, some of the girls were saying, it makes you ask where God was at the time of the explosion. That's their reaction. That's the characteristic reaction of man, isn't it? You see, God is meant to be, I mean, we are the people who are pioneering the universe, and God should jolly well see to it that nothing happens to harm us while we do it. Now, that's cynical, of course, but I mean, that's in effect what they're saying. Why doesn't God support us in all that we do? I wouldn't put it like that, because it sounds as though we're saying that he doesn't care for these things. But it is, of course, a ludicrous way of looking at things, isn't it? It's upside down. However, when wars come, and some of you will remember the war, some of you antique ones like me, and there's a headmaster not very far away from here who I knew as a boy who lost his faith just through the war. When these things happen, these catastrophes, they seem to suggest that God is gone, but to the fanatical Christian, they suggest that the end is near. And there are masses of publishers to bring out that kind of thing today. But what does Jesus say, verse 7? He says, the end is not yet. Isn't that very, very striking? You see, we have Hal Lindsey's book, 3 million copies of the late great planet Earth. 3 million copies. That's what that kind of thing sells. All drivel. Well, yes, but we mustn't just say the end is not yet. We must add something, as Jesus does. This is... one of these men falling through the window this time. Was that me? That's not the electrics, is it? Oh, I may have been. Thank you, John. John's over practical. You see, he's not apocalyptic. He doesn't look up there for things. So, you see, what is it? It's but the beginning of sorrows. Isn't that an incredible phrase? The beginning of sorrows. So when all these terrible things happen, and the telly rather loves it, doesn't it? It's, you know, it's what keeps telly news going. One terrific catastrophe after another. It's but the beginning. But it's better translated, isn't it? Not sorrows, but birth pangs. And some of you can remember when that happened, can't you? And you got up at 12 at night, and you wheeled out the car from the garage, took your wife off, didn't you? Because you expected something to happen. So you see, it's a perfect balance, isn't it? The end is not yet, but it's the beginning of birth pangs. Something's going to happen, all right. It's only the beginning. You see, contrast this to the false prophet with his signs. What is the false prophet doing? The false prophet, as one commentator says, exploits to the full the natural craving of the disciple to escape from the painful paradoxes and tensions and indirectness of faith into the comfortable security of sight. That's exactly right. That's what he's offering. He wants to release us from the painful insecurity of our situation, where we're telling people that Christ reigns, but everything seems to show the opposite. The false prophet comes along with a neat proof to show us visibly that he does reign, because he does signs and wonders just in front of our eyes. All an illusion for which we must pay no attention at all. First, then, the false prophet is a sign of the church age. Very, very striking that. I just ask you to meditate on it. You can't digest all I'm saying this afternoon in 1 hour. It takes a long time to digest that God allows the false prophet to be a mark of our age. He allows catastrophe to be a mark of our age. But of course he does. Because what has this world done? It has visited his son with crucifixion. If you don't think that the most awful fact that's impossible to conceive, then you won't understand why God visits this world with catastrophes. This world is a place of bitter rebellion against God. So this world is not going to look like a comfortable landscape. It's going to be full of tragedy. Thirdly, the third great sign of his coming, verse 9 onwards, the testing of the church, bitter tribulations. Take heed to yourselves, they will deliver you up to councils, synagogues, governors, and kings, like Felix and Festus. And some of this is exceedingly painful, 12 and 13. Brother will deliver up brother to death, father, child. Child rise against parents. This must be this, I think. Sorry. But you see, as characteristically in Mark's presentation, sandwiched between these bitter experiences of tribulation is the purposes of God being fulfilled. Even if I am called to stand before Festus and Felix, it is in part that Festus and Felix should hear the gospel, since it has to go to all men and all nations. And the Festuses and Felixes of this world don't go to church. Anyway, they're going to hear the gospel as if they are sitting on the magistrate's seat and a Christian comes in front of them. So you see, in the worst paragraph in the chapter, which is 9 to 13, which is all about tribulation, and by the way, that's why amillennialists, if I pronounce it right, believe that the Great Tribulation is the church age. And the second coming, of course, is after the tribulation. The Great Tribulation has gone on since the ascension to the return of Christ. And we can, you see, all that means very little to people who live in the comfortable life of Victorian England, which loved talking about pre, post, and A. But if you happen to live in the gulag, you may find that it's rather easier to understand that the Great Tribulation is now. Fourthly, the fourth mark, fourth sign that Christ reigns, is the pagan desecration of holy things, verse 14 onwards. Now, it is interesting to see the difference between Mark and Luke, because Luke very definitely ties this to the destruction of Jerusalem. But Mark is more careful, is more general. And I think the reason for this is that Mark wants us to understand, as indeed I think all the New Testament writers do, that this is a sign that will be repeated. Not just in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, not just in AD 70, not just in the time of the Maccabees, but there will be many, many days when the desolating sacrilege will be set up where it ought not to be. So it is simply a plain statement that one of the marks of the church age is that the pagans will set up their idolatrous and desolating sacrileges in the place of holy things. And you find that Mark is not really interested in being a prophet. He's a pastor. So what does he say about this? Well, he tells us what our part is and what God's part is. He says, as far as our part is in, flee to the mountains. Alas for those who give child. Do all you can to get away from it. For in those days there will be such tribulation as not been from the beginning of the creation. See, again, we mustn't be too literalistic there. Yes, the Josephus's account of the surrounding of Jerusalem by the Roman soldiers is one of the most horrifying pages in military history. But there have been equally appalling times in the history of the church since. So our part is to flee and to escape if we can. The Lord's part is to shorten the day, verse 20. It's all absolutely up to date. What about Uganda? What about Idi Amin? What happened was that the desolating sacrilege was set up in the holy place, wasn't it? He calls in Archbishop Luum and treats him like a common criminal and kills him in front of his eyes. So what happens to the Christians? Well, you probably heard Festo Cavendry tell the story of how he and his wife walked out of Uganda all night. They did exactly what this tells them to do. That when the pagan sets up his desolating sacrileges, so to speak, and is threatening to treat the church as only a pagan can, as an Idi Amin can, then the Christians are wise to flee for their lives, which is what Festo did, and he wouldn't be the great preacher he is today if he and his wife had not walked all night out of Uganda. He'd have been killed, like everybody else was being killed. So the pastoral advice is fly for your lives, and the assurance and comfort is God will shorten the days. So there then are the four great signs, if you like. I don't know whether you call them signs. I don't quite know what you call them, except that Andrew asked for a sign. The great hallmarks, if you like, of a godless world in which is a living church, God reigning over them all. There will be false prophets. There will be natural and international catastrophes. There will be a great testing of the church. There will be a pagan desecration of holy things. But, above all, there will be the proclamation of the universal gospel and the preservation of the church. And that'll be the greatest sign of all. And, of course, China in our own time is a marvelous indication of that sign, isn't it? The gospel reached the uttermost parts of China, and the church has not only been preserved but has been multiplied 100-fold since Christ was in the person of his missionaries cast out. Verse 24, in those days after that tribulation, now we're coming to the end, the sun will be darkened, the stars will fall, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds of great power and glory. Yes, there will be an end. We shall see him come in great power and glory. And what will he do when he comes in great power and glory? Well, the godless world has scattered the flock of Christ to the uttermost parts of the earth, seeking to destroy the church. So what do the angels do? They bring it all back again. They're sent out to the far winds of the earth, you see, and the heavens, to bring in his elect. Nobody can destroy them, no one can disperse them, no one can divide them. They're all brought back to their Lord and Master, to meet him. 28-31 is really very simple. From the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Here are the signs of summer, that the fig tree begins to have leaves. Verse 29, so also, when you see these things taking place, you know he is near. So just as you tell that summer is coming, when the fig tree begins to produce its leaves, so when these signs are visible to you, you know that Jesus is near. Now, when are these signs visible to us? Well, verse 30 and 31 make it quite plain. First, verse 30, I say to you, this generation shall not pass away before all these things take place. Exactly. In other words, all those signs were seen by that generation. Verse 31, heaven and earth will not pass away, but my words will not pass away. In other words, what I say is going to continue to the end of time. So the first generation saw the signs, and there never will be a generation that doesn't see the signs. Because God's word is the last word. See, this is our great reformed statement, isn't it? Just as the sacrifice was the last sacrifice, the word is the last word. Modern evangelicalism is wanting to say there are lots of new words. And you see, we've got to start saying, no, there's no new word. We don't want to listen to you. Because the words that he gave there about the signs are the only words we need to tell us what is going on today. We don't need any other prophets. He's given us a full prospectus. So the first generation saw false prophets, and so does our generation. The first generation saw catastrophe, so does our generation. The first generation saw tribulation, so does our generation. And the first generation saw the pagan desecration of holy things, and so does our generation. So there will never be a time without them, these signs, that is. So naturally, we need no more instructions, no more promises, no more predictions, no more assurances than he gives us here. Don't be alarmed, don't be anxious, don't be misled. I've told you. So, I can't think of a good illustration, but it's rather as though a Concorde pilot goes off to Heathrow and he tells his wife that he's got a lot of John Sainsbury's and people going across the Atlantic all this week and he doesn't know when he'll be back. But Concorde always goes across Kew Gardens at exactly the same time every day. As you know, if you live in London, you'll know just when it passes by. It goes past over this part of London at 6 o'clock. And so when that noise, which is quite unmistakable, it's quite unlike any other aeroplane, when that noise happens at 6 o'clock and the child is being put to bed, it says, well, that's Daddy, he's near. Mother says, I don't know when he's coming back, but they hear the signs that he's near. All these signs in the chapter say, he's near, but I don't know when he's returning. But I do know he's near, and every time I see these signs, I know he's near. Verse 32, of course, just means let God be God. We all want to play God today. That's why there's so much intolerance today, you see. It's a new intolerance sweeping evangelicalism, isn't there? Perhaps it's a reaction to the old woolly, over-tolerant attitude of some other days. But now we have people writing paperbacks, and if you don't believe exactly what they say about the situation in the future, then you're out of court. Get that spirit very much, don't you, in the Restoration 1 and Restoration 2 churches, especially in the Restoration 2 churches. And people love to have it so, don't they? People love to have men playing God. We're not allowed to do it. Mark is right. Well, now, I don't know whether there's four signs of judgment, false prophets, catastrophes, tribulation, and desecration. I don't know whether they're meant to be signs or whether they're just marks of judgment in the church age. I think it may be that the sign that Peter and Andrew and James and John was really given is the positive sign of salvation, that in the middle of all this catastrophe, the gospel is being proclaimed to the whole world, and the people of God are being preserved for the last day. And that is the most wonderful sign, isn't it? See, I mean, if you sat and listened to Luke 13, and that's the future, and you say, well, what hope is there for the gospel? And then you look at the world today and you see the gospel has reached everywhere. Cannot be hindered. And then if you see all the things that are going to happen to the church, you say, well, there's going to be a big fallout. And then you're told, no, that all the elect will be gathered together by the angels. Right, well, amazingly, I did all that in 3/4 of an hour. But probably at the cost of clarity. Anybody want to ask questions on that or make comments on that? We have a little time till tea. I think we'd better earn our cup of tea, don't you?
Is the fall of Jerusalem to bound up?
Is what?
The fall of Jerusalem, AD 70. Do you think that's actually bound up? Do you think that's in Jesus' mind when he says this?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. But I think when Mark is recounting to it, he doesn't want us to be entirely bogged down. Let me read Cranfield on this. It's such a magnificent note. Luke rightly recognized in the events of 66 to 70 a fulfillment of Jesus' words, but it was not a fulfillment without remainder. There was more to come. The new Israel, like the old, would be sinful and would again and again be menaced by divine judgment, and Antichrist would again and again embody himself in proud and sacrilegious men. Thus, in the crises of history, the eschatological is foreshadowed. The divine judgments in history are, so to speak, rehearsals of the last judgment, and the successive incarnations of Antichrist are foreshadowings of the last supreme concentration of the rebelliousness of the devil before the end. I think that's right. We're having constant foreshadowings of judgment and of all these things. No, it's just a guarantee that he's Lord. I just want to keep it simple this afternoon. You see? It couldn't be. That is inconceivable to them as they're harried out of their homes and they escape to the little mountains, isn't it? It's inconceivable to say Jesus is Lord. It seems mad, and yet he was being Lord because Jerusalem had to be broken up. And in fact, God used the Romans to send the gospel to the far ends of the earth. So he was Lord in the destruction of Jerusalem. So all that we're learning from this is that all the things that seem to us to show that God isn't there are actually signs of the opposite. That's how I understand the chapter. And all the things that seem to us to suggest that the church can't survive are signs of the opposite. See, he's not doing a conjuring trick. He's trying to face us up to the fact that if we say these words and we know it so well, just try and stand back for a moment. But do your man from Mars business. Man from Mars comes down and he's told that the God who made this world visited it once. He says, well, you must have given him a great reception. And then he's told what we did. Well, the man from Mars is going to say just what the parable of the vineyard say. What is God going to do with this lot? And the answer is not just that he's going to judge this lot, nor just that he's going to save this lot. In judgment will come salvation. Both will be happening. And there will be all around us the terrible signs of a Christ-rejecting world. But there will also be around us, for the eye of faith, the wonderful signs of an irresistible gospel. You can't have the one without the other. And these present signs and wonders, boys, you see, are trying to tell us that we can have, that the only way to show that Christ is saving men is to show us that he's removing all the signs of agony as well. We live in a world of agony, we shall never live in anything else. To imagine that by waving a wand we can wave them away is to be utterly naive. But I don't need to say that to you, because you live in the real world, you men who are in actual churches, don't you? People are dying and children are having terrible accidents and families are splitting. You live in that world, so you don't need telling this. But we all would prefer to live in a fairy tale world. Any other comments on this? Gerald. No, I can't, except to say that I think this new book, Paperback by Walker, is worth skimming through. I just skimmed through it on a rail journey. I think it's Hodder and Stoughton, isn't it? And this fellow Walker, I don't know who he is, but he's just made a journalistic, a very good survey of what's happening and who they are. I didn't even know who they were. And where one and two stem from. And of course, they're full of good people as well as less good things. But I certainly was a great deal unhappier at the end than I was at the beginning. Now, he's by no means anti them, but he's very honest. What is the title of the book?
Restoring the Kingdom.
Restoring the Kingdom, thank you. Andrew Walker. Thank you. Thank you so much, brother. Yes, he's a very curious animal, isn't he, with his Pentecostal upbringing and having finished up in Russian Orthodox. Yes, he's a great C.S. Lewis fan. Of course, it's where many of these people are going to finish up, you see, because if you live in that total subjectivity, in the end, you're like a drowning man. And so you go to these Orthodox churches where it's all objective. It's all, in a sense, done for you, and you just rest in that, and there is something wonderfully relaxing and restful in that after this constant man-centered striving. I understand why they finish up there. That's why lots of these people are going to finish up, of course, if they're not going to finish up in unbelief. I think I'm not a great fan of some of Hendrickson's later commentaries, because I think once a man is asked to turn out endless commentaries, it becomes impossible. But his first commentary is a work of genius if you've not read More Than Conquerors. It's a most brilliant piece of work. I don't get anything that's been written better on the Book of Revelation myself. Because he makes it such a practical book for people in difficulties. Well, let's go to tea. I hope that you can see the thrill of the place of chapter 13 in it. It's just getting us again on balance for tomorrow, you see. We've really finished the main teaching, but we're now going to go into the end, 14 and 15, and we're going to see the Lord crucified. We really need to know before we get there what it's all going to mean. And it's going to mean two things, judgment and salvation.